There. Party's ready to proceed?
Yes.
Excellent.
Good morning. May it please the court. Casey Granis on behalf of Catherine St. Clair. This case raises two issues.
You wish to reserve any time?
Oh, yes. I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you. This case raises two issues. One, a challenge to the two convict instruction on each count. The second issue is a challenge to jury unanimity and whether that was protected based on the alternative means. I'll turn first to the defective two convict instruction. The problem with the two convict is that it permitted an interpretation that misstated the law and lowered the state's burden of proof. The problem is that in the way that the elements are divided, the mens rea element of negligence that needed to be proved is decoupled from the culpable criminal action that needed to be proved.
Help me understand their argument. Isn't that typical of most two convict instructions, where they have the mental element in one as one element and then the actus reus or the other steps as other elements?
Well, in the typical two convict instructions that I've seen, whatever the offense at issue, you've got when the mental element is included in as one of the elements, it's linked with the actus reus at issue in some manner. So it's specified what that mens rea element is attaching to. And it's that link, or the missing link here, that's problematic. Now, our analysis is framed by the basic legal standard that jury instructions must do more than adequately convey the law. Now, we look at this two-convict instruction here. Does it adequately convey the law? When looked at from the perspective of trained...
It had every element that the state was required to prove in it, didn't it? Every element was set forth in the instruction.
Well, when we say element, though, when we're talking about the mens rea element, the burden of proof for that is necessarily attached to what the actus reus is. And that's the problem here. Yeah, so in element two, that the defendant acted with negligence. That's in there. No dispute about that.
Is there any other mental state mentioned in the instruction that could have caused the jury any confusion?
There's no one
that was required to be proved, and that's the only one that was set forth in the instruction.
Negligence was the only required culpable mental state that needed to be proved.
So in what way is the jury going to be misled or confused about what the law is in this case?
What we have in the record is a jury inquiry. Now, that jury doesn't make that inquiry if this instruction makes the law manifestly apparent to the average juror. The jury's asking whether dehydration and starvation, as to the actus reus involved here, whether that implies intent. Why is the jury asking that question?
Isn't that favorable to Ms. St. Clair, though? I mean, that they're saying, well, is the state required to prove intent versus criminal negligence? That's a higher burden, isn't it?
Well, that cuts both ways, though. Okay. Because when the jury's asking, well, is intent implied? And the court comes back and doesn't give them any further guidance on that, what does the jury do? I mean, it's speculation at that point. They could go one way or the other. They could go, well, maybe the state does need to prove intent, which would go to your theory, Your Honor. But also, the other way the jury could have gone is that, well, I guess they don't need to prove intent. And what we're left with is, what, no culpable mental state attaching to the dehydration or the starvation acts? Maybe we find Ms. St. Clair guilty because, yes, she acted negligently in some fashion, and there's no dispute in this case that the evidence showed that there was negligent action here. I mean, the jury, we have to put ourselves in the shoes of an average juror. That's hard for us as trained legal professionals, but that's what we need to do here. The jury, from the perspective of the jury, they're looking at the evidence that's presented to them.
Your argument is that the jury may have found some form of negligence, but not criminal negligence.
Not criminal negligence attached to the actus reus that the state needed to prove. That's the argument in a nutshell. And again, is adequately convey the law is not good enough here. It's got to be manifestly apparent to the average juror. The jury's inquiry shows that there was a problem here, but it wasn't manifestly apparent.
How should the two convict instruction then have been written?
Here's my proposal. For element 1A that goes to starvation, it should have read, it should have tracked the statutory language. With criminal negligence, the defendant starved an animal. That's 1A. 1B, with criminal negligence, the defendant dehydrated an animal. That's how it should have read. That would have been manifestly apparent. And again, that tracks the statutory language. This problem would have been solved if these instructions just tracked the statutory language. But, you know, there's no pattern instruction for this offense. The prosecution which proposed this instruction didn't follow the statutory language. They came up with this instruction, but it's problematic because it permits an erroneous interpretation of a law. And, you know, two convict instructions, they're subject to harmless error analysis. There's a presumption that the instruction was prejudicial. The state on appeal hasn't even bothered to argue that these instructions were harmless. And as pointed out by St. Clair in the opening brief, this element of whether she was negligent in terms of starvation and dehydration, that was a controverted element. And sure, looking at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, you know, maybe the jury would have found this, would have convicted anyway, but that's not the standard we apply to whether this instructional error was harmless. The element was controverted, the evidence went both ways. St. Clair put on her case, so that this instructional error can't be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And for that reason, we ask that the convictions for each count be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Andrew Alsdorf on behalf of Snohomish County, representing the state of Washington. I'm also joined in the courtroom by the lead investigator in this case and in the Mary Peterson case, Angela Wrench. Your Honor, the alleged instructional error in this case was not error at all, but it certainly was not a error amounting to a manifest constitutional error as has been defined in our jurisprudence. Because as Your Honor said, each and every element of the crime and the requisite burden of proof was set forth in the jury instruction. And you're absolutely right that there are many crimes that the two convict instruction is separates out the mens rea element as a separate unique element, as it should. Our jurisprudence talks about actus reus, mens rea, and causation, usually in that order, and that is exactly how the instruction was set forth here. So I would submit that it would be an expansion of the definition of manifest constitutional error to give any credit to this decoupling or floating argument about the mens rea in this case. I think this is inappropriate for appellate review because the defendant did not propose jury instructions of his own, as is required under Criminal Rule 6.15. He did not object to the prosecutor's version of this jury instruction, for which there is no pattern instruction. It's sort of implied in the briefing and at oral argument here today that it was some sort of sin on the prosecutor's part to propose or craft an instruction at all. Well, we have to tell them something, and the only party that came up with anything to tell them was the prosecutor. I absolutely think that...
Is that kind of a it's good enough for government work argument?
No, not at all.
I mean, the obligation is to come up with something that's correct, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
And I'll...
So, counsel offered one alternative. Looking at the way that this was phrased, the third element starts out as a result, comma.
That's right.
If the second element had been phrased in so doing, comma, the defendant acted, then we wouldn't even be here talking about this, right? you'd have acted in by one or more methods. Two, in so doing, the defendant acted. Three, as a result, the animal suffered. It actually reads well.
I will at least give credence to the idea that on appellate review, it is easy to add additional words that could have made things even more clear. But I would also say that the more wordy we get, sometimes lawyers are tend to do that. And in fact, adding more words can sometimes detract from an average juror's understanding. I would submit that the ordering of the elements themselves and the linkage through the common verbs acted in the first two elements, and then finally linking the first two elements with the phrase as a result, does provide a plain common reading of these linked elements as one following the other and all being linked together. Element one, the defendant acted. Element two, the defendant acted with criminal negligence. Element three, as a result. So when we take all of those together, we see that they are linked. And so I don't think that the argument holds that this was a misstatement of the law or even confusing. Now, I submitted a case, the NG case. I don't want to mispronounce it, but it's the NG case from 1988. That talks about how dangerous it can be to infer anything from a jury's question. I think that holds here. The jury asked about, does this imply intent? And in fact, once again, this was a situation where no one objected to the court's proposed answer. And in fact, the answer is pretty much the standard answer, referred back to your jury instructions. When they did refer back to their jury instructions, they would have seen the definition of criminal negligence, which talks to them about intent, says, well, if you found intent, criminal negligence has been satisfied. So that, unless the court has further questions about the to convict instruction, I believe appellate review is not appropriate for that issue. I would like to take some time to address an opportunity that I think this case presents to reevaluate whether starvation and dehydration are in fact true alternative means as that jurisprudence has developed in the last 3 years.
Do you agree that sufficient evidence was presented on both of those means of committing the crime?
I do, Your Honor.
If we agree with that, do we need to even get to the place you want us to go?
I think it goes the other way. I think if you agree with me that they are starvation and dehydration are no longer true alternative means,
law in this division already addressing that issue, though.
It does, and that's from the Peterson case in 2013. The only real analysis, I think the state conceded the issue in the briefing, but as written in the opinion in Peterson, the only real basis for declaring that these two verbs, starvation and dehydration, are alternative means was based on the Hickman case, the law of the case doctrine, which we know has been apparently overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court in Musascio.
Well, it didn't overrule the law of the case doctrine. What Musascio says and what Tyler said was that the 14th Amendment right to appellate review of proof beyond a reasonable doubt doesn't apply to extra elements, that a constitutional right can't be created by a trial court's, a state court mistake. That's what it says. Let me ask you something more to the point here. I'm intrigued by your footnote number one. In your footnote number one in your briefing.
Do you know what page that's on?
I don't, okay. But I'm doing pretty good to remember that it was footnote number one. That would be the first footnote you put in your brief.
So I'm looking.
I can help you that way. You point out that 1652-205 could be viewed as having alternative means set forth in subsection 1, subsection 2, and subsection 3. When I look at subsection 1, it begins, a person is guilty of animal cruelty in the first degree when. subsection 2 begins, a person is guilty of animal cruelty in the first degree when. Subsection 3 begins, a person is guilty of animal cruelty in the first degree when. And subsection 4 says animal cruelty in the first degree is a Class C felony. That appears to be a fairly traditional way of the legislature setting forth alternative means. You, however, in footnote 1, disclaim the argument. So my question is, have you waived the ability to have me, in this case, reach a determination that subsection 1, subsection 2, and subsection 3 are actually where the alternative means are found, and that starving and dehydration are just means within a means, and the Supreme Court has been clear that the unanimity requirement does not apply to means within a means?
I do think that the issue is squarely before this court. What I meant in footnote 1 was that the defendant has not challenged, because the case wasn't charged under subsections 1 or 3. So having been charged exclusively under subsection 2, that was the source of the jury instructions and therefore the primary focus of the language we're talking about. That's where you find starvation and dehydration. Now, I don't think that a ruling on starvation and dehydration within the context of subsection 2 precludes you from saying anything about subsections 1 or 3. I just think that it hasn't been put forward to the court in briefing.
Well, I mean, just to be clear, it's possible that I am persuaded by your argument that Peterson is wrongly decided, but convinced that what the analysis that you substitute for the analysis in Peterson is even more screwed up than Peterson is. And so to adopt that would be to make things worse. This seems to be quite neat, but it isn't what you're arguing. You tell me it's not what you're arguing. Where does that leave me?
Well, I think where it leaves you is we're asking – may I finish, Aaron?
You may.
We're asking you to – rule on the verbs starvation and dehydration in the sense that Sandholm and Owens talk about minor nuances in hearing in the same act. That's the core of my argument, and I think that is squarely before the court.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
I'd like to return to the instructional issue and follow up on Judge Spearman's, I think it was Judge Spearman's question about, well, what about other instructions with regard to other offenses and where the, how the mental element is framed in those cases. I'll throw out a couple examples to support my answer to that question in terms of how these other instructions and for other offenses actually link the action with the mental state at issue. WIPC 7702, possessing stolen property. This is how it reads, and it reads fine. That on or about the date the defendant knowingly received stolen property. So that's element one. Element two, that the defendant acted with knowledge that the property had been stolen. So we see the linkage there between the act and the mental state. Better example, WIPC 9602, negligent driving, element one, the defendant operated a motor vehicle. Element two, that the defendant operated the motor vehicle in a negligent manner. So again, we have this linkage here, and it's that linkage that's missing in the two convict instructions at issue in this case. Broadly speaking, did this instruction include the required actus reus? Yeah, that was there. Did it include a mental state? Yeah. But the problem is that linkage, though, is what's important to hold the state to its burden of proof. And that's not here. Now, in terms of, I've hammered the jury inquiry and the significance of that in this case. The state cites State v. Ng to say, well, let's turn a blind eye to that and ignore that jury inquiry. I submitted some statement of additional authority. Your Honors will have a chance to review that if they haven't already, where the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals, for that matter, on a number of occasions post-State v. Ng have looked at jury inquiries and attached significance to what they mean in terms of whether a jury was misled or whether the error at issue was prejudicial. The weight of authority is taking these inquiries into account. State v. Ng, I'd submit, is an outlier. And again, more recent Supreme Court precedent shows that they have taken these inquiries into account. In terms of the alternative means, we'll rest on our briefing on that one. And we ask this court to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next matter, State of Washington versus